Hi, my name is Mira Patasin. I'm an author and I'm an activist, and GoFundMe is my go-to platform for fundraising. The first GoFundMe I did was to raise money for a chapbook or a collection of poetry and essays and short stories. So we started a GoFundMe and our goal was $7,000. What I've learned is so special about GoFundMe is that it's a whole collection of people offering anything from like $4 to $400. And each time you get a ping that someone donated, even if it is just $4, it's so exciting. So if you have a goal and you get there, you can keep making it bigger and bigger and bigger. We did go past our goal. It was amazing.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive, where we tear through a stack of sources and pull out the essential knowledge nuggets customized just for you. Today, we're tackling a figure who has built this really extraordinary career, sort of mastering a tightrope walk. You know,
definitely. Between being an esteemed journalist, a hugely influential activist,
and arguably maybe the most abrasive cultural provocateur of his generation.
Yeah, that feels about right. We are deep diving into the life and work of Dan Savage.
It's quite a career to unpack.
It's truly sprawling. Yeah, multifaceted. Born in 1964, Savage basically channeled his sex advice column, Savage Love, into this massive global platform.
Books, TV, social campaigns.
Right. And our mission today really is to understand the mechanics of that. How did he leverage talking frankly about sex and relationships into, well, a tool?
A tool for progressive politics, for LGBTQ rights advocacy.
And just, you know, relentless public debate, often very controversial debate.
And when you look at the evidence, I mean, the success of that platform is just undeniable. Before we even get into the controversies or the whole media empire thing, let's try and nail down his core identity, his major achievements.
Yeah, the writing and punditry are vital, sure. But you're right, the activism really defines him in many ways.
So where do we start with that? What's the cornerstone?
I think that has to be the starting point. The single most visible, most defining achievement of his activism is co-founding the It Gets Better project.
Right, in 2010 with his husband, Terry Miller.
Exactly. And this was a direct digital intervention aimed squarely at preventing suicide among LGBTQ youth who were facing bullying.
And that project, it really shifted the conversation, didn't it?
Fundamentally, yeah. How society addresses queer youth, isolation, mental health. It was huge.
An incredible achievement. Digital advocacy at its most impactful, really. Mm-hmm. And then, like, on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, but still talking cultural impact.
You have to mention the language.
Yes. His influence on just everyday sexual language.
Yeah. The sources are clear. Savage and his readership, they officially coined the neologism pegging back in 2001.
Defining a woman anally penetrating a man with his strap-on dildo.
Correct.
And that word, it didn't just stay niche, did it? It wasn't just in the alt weeklies.
No, not at all. It pretty quickly infiltrated mainstream sexual vocabulary. You hear it everywhere now.
It's amazing.
It is. And that little linguistic act, it kind of perfectly encapsulates his specific genius, I think.
How so?
Well, he treats sex advice seriously, right?
Yeah.
But he does it in a way that generates real cultural, even linguistic gravity.
He turns these private, intimate things
into public political discussion, often with really surprising, far-reaching results.
Okay, so let's unpack the origins then.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of hard to imagine the guy behind Savage Love starting out, well, where he did.
Yeah, it's quite a journey.
How does a kid from Chicago who is seriously considering the priesthood end up creating a sex advice empire?
Right. That brings us to section one, the unexpected path to advice columnist.
So Chicago native.
Savage. Yeah. Daniel Keenan Savage. Born in Chicago, October 7, 1964. And raised strictly Roman Catholic.
Ah, okay. That upbringing, that's got to be a foundational layer, right? Even though he later moved away from it.
Absolutely. He later identified more as an atheist, or maybe his term, a wishy-washy agnostic.
But he still called himself culturally Catholic. You can almost feel that tension in his writing sometimes.
You really can. That exploration of sin, morality, challenging dogma. It's all there.
Baked in from the start.
Mm-hmm. And his high school choice kind of reinforces this early religious path. He attended Quigley Preparatory Seminary North.
Which was specifically for?
For boys, considering the priesthood. So a deep immersion in that formal religious structure, the rhetoric. it surely influenced his later style.
His very formal rhetorical style sometimes, yeah.
Definitely.
But clearly the path shifted towards performance.
It did. Big shift. He got a Bachelor of Fine Arts and acting degree from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
Okay, the acting background. That feels critical.
It's hugely important. He wasn't just a writer. He was a performer.
Yeah.
He understood staging, rhetoric, shock value, how to grab public attention.
You see it in his media appearances.
Totally. And remember, he later worked as a theater director sometimes, used the name Keenan Holohan. His whole public persona has this theatrical, very intentional quality.
Right. It's the performance degree that maybe makes him a media pundit, not just a journalist.
Good point.
So that performative flair, it eventually lands him in the right place, right time, early 90s.
Where was he when Savage Love started bubbling up? Around 1991.
He was in Madison, Wisconsin, working as the night manager at a video store.
A video store? What kind?
Called Four Star Fiction and Video, specialized in independent films. And crucially, this is where he befriended Tim Keck.
Ah, Tim Keck of the Onion fame.
One of the original co-founders, yeah.
And then Keck makes the move, Seattle.
Right. Keck moved to Seattle to start a new alternative weekly, The Stranger. And Savage gave him some advice.
What was the advice? Savage told him the paper had to have an advice column. It said something like, everybody claims to hate him, but everybody seems to read him.
Mm, probably true.
So Savage pitched himself, wrote a sample column. Keck was apparently blown away.
Offered him the job.
Savage moved to Seattle. And that decision, as Savage himself said, forever altered his life path. A total pivot.
So the column wasn't just like a gig. It was conceived as cultural commentary from day one.
Absolutely.
What was the core idea, the philosophy behind it?
It was provocative right out of the gate. Savage's stated intention was basically to provide mocking advice to heterosexuals.
Mocking them? Why?
He felt that the established, you know, straight advice columnists were often judgmental or just clueless when they tried to answer letters from gay people.
Ah, so he flipped the script.
Exactly. He took a deliberately confrontational stance. Decided to turn the tables on what he saw as the clueless cultural norm.
And this leads directly to one of his most, let's say, infamous rhetorical moves, right in the formatting of the column itself, the salutation.
Oh, yeah. His initial idea, which the editor shot down, was to call the whole column, "Hey, faggot."
Oh.
He wanted to reclaim the hate word. That was the idea. Editor said no to the title. But for several years, he successfully used "Hey, faggot" as the salutation at the start of every single printed letter.
That is astonishing. For a newspaper column, that level of provocation.
Right. He used that framing until 1999. That's nearly a decade.
Why did he stop?
He claimed he retired it only when he felt the reclamation had been successful, or maybe just when the shock value wasn't as useful anymore.
What does that tell you, though? About his early strategy.
It tells you Savage understood very early on that progressive social change could be driven by really aggressive, attention-grabbing confrontation.
His column was engineered for that.
Totally. Engineered as a vehicle for cultural critique, not just relationship help. Designed to force discomfort, make people notice.
Well, that framing certainly worked to build an audience. Which takes us right into section two, building the media platform. Once Savage Love found that defiant voice, it didn't stay local in Seattle for long.
No, it blew up pretty quickly. It became internationally syndicated, popping up in alt weeklies all over the U.S., Canada, eventually further afield.
But he wasn't just mailing it in from afar, right? He was involved with The Stranger.
Deeply involved. He eventually became editor-in-chief and then editorial director there.
Which gave him significant local political influence in Seattle.
Huge clout, yeah.
And while he's primarily known as an LGBTQ advocate, he was smart. He broadened his focus to what he called straight rights issues.
Yeah, arguing that the sort of political war on sex was universal.
How did he frame that?
He basically made the case that the right-wingers and the fundies and the sex phobes, as he put it, weren't just targeting the queer community.
They were coming for your asses, too.
Exactly. His words. He focused on conservative opposition to things like the HPV vaccine, the morning after pill, stuff that affects everyone.
So by fighting for access to mainstream sexual health stuff.
He positioned sex positivity as a necessary defense for everyone against, you know, prudish government control over people's bodies and lives.
It's actually a really brilliant way to broaden the political base for sexual freedom. Makes it universal.
Totally. And that philosophy that sex is universal, it translated perfectly into audio with the Savage Lovecast.
Ah, yes, the podcast. Let's do a real deep dive here. How does the Lovecast actually work?
So it's a weekly audio podcast, basically an extension of the column. But what makes it unique is how he gets the questions.
How's that?
Callers leave anonymous questions on a dedicated voice recorder, like an old school answering machine, essentially.
Okay. And then he answers them on the show.
Right. And unlike typical radio call-in shows, he often actually returns the calls. So the live recorded conversation becomes part of the show itself.
Oh, interesting. That must create a different kind of feel, more immediate.
It really does. It creates this sense of intimacy, authenticity, and the structure is dynamic, you know?
Yeah.
It's funny, it's serious.
But he's careful with the advice, right? Especially medical stuff.
Yeah, that's crucial. He's very responsible about expertise. For questions that are complex or medical, he often consults doctors, sex therapists, relationship experts, sometimes calls them live on the show.
And he'll say it's above my pay grade.
Explicitly, yeah. He's the funny, frank guide who knows exactly when to bring in the science or the therapy professional.
The combination must be key to its success.
I think so. That blend of, like, frank comedy and responsible fact-checking, it's why the Lovecast is consistently recognized.
It's huge, right? Top of the iTunes charts in health.
Routinely.
Yeah.
And often in the top 20 podcasts overall. Got nods from the AV Club, The Atlantic. It's a massive media success.
Proving that whole alt-weekly vibe could really thrive in the digital age.
Definitely.
And beyond the core column in the podcast, he became a pretty central figure in broader media, too.
He certainly did. He had an early call-in show, Savage Love Live, way back 94 to 97.
And an online column for ABC News?
Yeah. Dear Dan, 98 to 2000. He became a familiar voice on public radio, too. Frequent contributor to This American Life.
And politically on TV.
He was a real-time, real reporter on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher for a while. Always in the mix.
And we can't forget those acting roots. You mentioned the theater work he did under the name Kenan Hollihan.
Right, that acting background wasn't just history. It led him to found Seattle's Greek Active Theater.
What was their thing?
Known for taking classic works and giving them these queer interpretations, staging a tragicomic Macbeth, for instance, playing with gender roles.
It's that kind of theatrical impulse reinterpreting classics that you see in his cultural critiques later.
Totally connects. Although, as our sources note, his own attempt at playwriting, Letters from the Earth in 2003.
Oh, yeah. What happened there?
It got an absolutely scathing review from his own paper at The Stranger.
Ouch. That's got a sting.
Famously brutal, but also kind of self-aware for the paper. It highlighted that alt-weekly philosophy, critique has to be ruthless, applied equally, even to the boss.
Fair enough. Okay, let's shift to his television work. He had that MTV series, Savage U, but the really significant TV project was The Real O'Neills on ABC, right?
Yeah, that was a bigger deal. Savage was an executive producer on that, ran for 2 seasons on network TV.
And it was based on his idea.
Based on his concept, yeah. About this seemingly perfect, tight-knit, Irish-American Catholic family in Chicago.
Whose secrets all come tumbling out.
Exactly. Triggered when the middle child comes out as gay.
This feels like his core political work smuggled onto mainstream TV. Like a Trojan horse.
It really kind of is. The show reveals, okay, the middle kid's gay, the oldest daughter's anorexic, the youngest is maybe an atheist running some scam, and the parents want a divorce but are hiding it.
Wow, all the secrets.
It takes all that deeply personal pain and complexity, especially for queer youth in strict religious homes, and puts it right into a primetime network comedy.
That's a deliberate act of normalization, using major media exposure.
Absolutely.
That move from private pain to public platform, that's the perfect bridge to Section 3. The blending of private life and public activism. Savage's personal life, it seems, has never really been separate from his political mission.
No, they're completely intertwined. His own family life is totally central to his advocacy work.
So, he and Terry Miller, his husband, they married early, right? Before it was widely legal?
They did. They first married in Vancouver, Canada, back in 2005, long before same-sex marriage was recognized across most of the U.S.
Just going to Canada to get married back then was a political act in itself.
It absolutely was, a form of protest, a statement.
And then, when Washington State finally legalized same-sex marriage,
they made sure their commitment was highly visible. When it became legal in Washington in 2012, they were among the very first couples to get state marriage licenses.
They got married publicly.
Yeah, at Seattle City Hall, December 9, 2012, along with other couples, it was a very calculated, very public declaration of equality.
And the couple also adopted a son around 98.
Yeah, adopted their son DJ as an infant around 1998. And Savage was incredibly public about that whole process.
He wrote a book about it, didn't he?
He did. Chronicled that whole intense personal journey in his 1999 book, The Kid. What happened after my boyfriend and I decided to go get pregnant?
That book must have been really important for normalizing queer families.
Hugely important. Showed the emotional side, the logistical hurdles, the legal realities of gay couples building a family through adoption. It basically turned their private story into foundational reading for the movement.
Okay, let's pivot to the It Gets Better project. The name itself is now like a global mantra. What was the specific tragedy that kicked it off?
The project was founded September 21st, 2010. Directly in response to the suicide of a 15-year-old named Billy Lucas.
Who was bullied.
Relentlessly bullied, yeah, for his perceived sexual orientation. Savage and Miller saw this awful tragedy and just felt they had to do something, leverage their platform.
And the idea was simple, but powerful.
Incredibly effective. Just ask adults, queer, straight, famous, regular folks to submit video testimonials.
Hi, my name is Mira Patasin. I'm an author and I'm an activist, and GoFundMe is my go-to platform for fundraising. The first GoFundMe I did was to raise money for a chapbook or a collection of poetry and essays and short stories. So we started a GoFundMe and our goal was $7,000. What I've learned is so special about GoFundMe is that it's a whole collection of people offering anything from like $4 to $400. And each time you get a ping that someone donated, even if it is just $4, it's so exciting. So if you have a goal and you get there, you can keep making it bigger and bigger and bigger. We did go past our goal. It was amazing.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
The judge is assuring LGBTQ youth that life absolutely gets better after the hell of high school bullying and isolation.
Flood the internet with hope, basically.
That was the goal, and the response was just staggering. The scale tells you how desperately that message was needed.
How big did it get?
By November 2013, so just about 3 years later, the project had over 50,000 user-created videos, testimonials, and over 50 million views combined.
Wow. That's incredible velocity from a heartfelt response to this massive digital movement.
And it got major recognition, too.
Awards.
Yeah. Won a Webby Award for Special Achievement in 2011 and, significantly, the Emmy Governor's Award in 2012.
The Governor's Award, that's a big deal. It's for achievements beyond standard TV categories, right?
Exactly. It's cemented. It gets better not just as successful activism, but as, like, essential public service media. Really profound impact.
Okay, so moving from life-saving activism to... well, something very different. Boundary-pushing art. We have to talk about the annual HMP Film Festival that Savage coordinates.
Right. The juxtaposition is classic Savage. That cognitive dissonance he relies on to keep everyone talking.
It feels like a radical move. What exactly is HMP?
It's an annual pornography festival. It showcases short 5-minute porn clips submitted by viewers. Basically, anyone can submit on any pornographic topic they want.
And it's successful. It tours.
Hugely successful. Tours theaters across the country every year.
But the curation, the philosophy behind it, that's the key part, right?
Yeah.
It's not just random homemade porn.
No, exactly. The unique element, and this is the political statement, is the mixing. The winning submissions are all shown together.
Mixing what?
Deliberately mixing straight porn, gay male porn, bi, lesbian fetish stuff. All one after another in the same program.
Oh, okay, breaking down the silos.
Right. It challenges the traditional, highly segregated way the porn industry usually works. Suggests all kinds of sexual experiences deserve space on the screen, together.
And there's that final, crucial detail. What happens to the films afterwards?
Savage publicly destroys all the submissions after the tour ends.
Destroys them, why?
It acts as a kind of protective mechanism for the filmmakers. By destroying the tapes, he ensures this ephemeral homemade art isn't permanently exploited or leaked outside the festival context.
Gives the amateur participants a layer of security.
Exactly. Security that traditional commercial porn definitely doesn't offer. It's performance art, sure, but layered with these ethical considerations for the people involved.
It really seems like Savage has this history of not just writing about things, but outright weaponizing language for his campaigns. Which takes us perfectly into section 4. Campaigns and controversial neologisms.
Mm-hmm.
We absolutely have to start with the infamous Santorum campaign 2003.
Yeah, that one's legendary. The catalyst was then U.S. Senator Rick Santorum. He gave this interview comparing homosexual sex to bestiality and incest.
Awful stuff.
Truly egregious. And Savage felt the attack was so harmful, so beyond the pale, that he needed a response beyond just a column. He launched a campaign, a cultural sabotage campaign, really.
He sponsored a contest, right, to redefine Santorum's last name.
Correct. Held a contest among his readers, and the result was coining the term Santorum.
Defined as?
Defined as the frothy mixture of lube and fecal matter that is sometimes the byproduct of anal sex.
Oh, my God.
And he didn't just coin it. He successfully leveraged the internet, set up a dedicated website, spreadingsantorum.com, I think it was, publicized the definition relentlessly.
With the specific goal of dominating search engine results for the senator's name.
Exactly. It was a modern, aggressive form of political action, using digital media, using gross-out humor, shock value, to inflict a very specific kind of reputational damage.
And it worked, didn't it?
Incredibly effective. Savage essentially turned the senator's name into this widely known scatological joke. It overshadowed a lot of his political messaging for years.
Did he ever offer to take it down?
He did in 2010, but with a political price tag. He said he'd remove the website if Santorum donated $5 million to Freedom to Marry, the gay rights organization.
Which Santorum obviously didn't do. He condemned the campaign.
Of course. Called it hateful, disgusting. Savage, in response, basically argued that his campaign, while aggressive, was nonviolent, and it was a direct response to Santorum propagating real discrimination and harm.
And that website, or the definition, it's still out there. A permanent digital scar.
It really proved the long-lasting power of a successfully weaponized neologism in the internet age.
And it wasn't a one-off strategy for him, was it? He used the same playbook in 2009 with the saddlebacking protest.
Right, saddlebacking. That was aimed at Pastor Rick Warren, head of Saddleback Church.
Why Warren?
Warren was a very vocal supporter of California's Proposition 8, the ballot measure that banned same-sex marriage.
And wasn't there controversy because Obama invited to the inauguration?
Exactly. That heightened it. President Obama invited Warren to give the invocation at his first inauguration. Savage used the neologism to protest both Warren's politics and Obama's association with him.
So what was the definition this time? Equally provocative.
Oh, yeah. It defined saddlebacking as the phenomenon of Christian teens engaging in unprotected anal sex to preserve their virginities.
Wow. Okay. Linky perceived hypocrisy about abstinence-only preaching.
With specific, often undiscussed sexual behaviors among some religious youth, designed purely to provoke and critique.
This kind of activism sometimes had consequences for him, though. Didn't a paper drop his column over Prop 8?
Yeah, the sources mentioned that the Salt Lake City Weekly dropped Savage Love after he vowed to boycott Utah because of the strong Mormon church support for Prop 8 there.
So he was willing to take the hit.
Seemed to be, yeah. If the goal was applying political pressure, and beyond these big national language-based campaigns, Savage was also a really powerful voice in local Seattle politics, mostly through The Stranger.
What was his big local fight?
His most high-profile local battle was against the Seattle Teen Dance Ordinance. And the related crackdowns on all ages, music venues, and events.
Fighting the no fun police.
Basically. It was a fight against what he saw as moral panic disguised as city governance. Savage argued, pretty forcefully, that closing down supervised venues, places like Ground Zero or the Kirkland Teen Center, it didn't stop teenagers from getting together.
It just pushed them somewhere else.
Exactly. Pushed them into unsupervised, potentially more dangerous situations. He specifically cited, like, 7-Eleven parking lots or unsupervised houses where boredom and lack of structure can lead to reckless behavior.
It's the classic Savage move, isn't it? Defend youth, defend fun, defend sex or dancing.
And use that as a wedge issue to fight broader government control and, you know, moral prudishness.
Looking at the pattern, national or local, he consistently frames these fights against sex phobes as fights for freedom, for self-determination.
And often, crucially, for the physical safety and well-being of young people.
That consistency, though, it brings us to Section 5, the hot zones of viewpoints and controversy. Because while Savage is generally seen as liberal, the sources make it clear he has this fierce contrarian streak.
Oh, definitely.
Which sometimes led him to attack his own allies or use language that just generated huge backlash.
his politics are, yeah, broadly liberal, but with these really undeniable libertarian and contrarian impulses just woven through. He constantly used his column to push readers, encourage them to voice opinions on politicians, get active, not passive.
An early sign of that libertarian side was his opposition to laws banning the sale of sex toys.
Yeah, that came up. When an adult video store owner in Mississippi got arrested after some local journalist did an expose.
What did Savage do?
He satirically suggested that his readers should mail all their unwanted sex toys directly to the journalist who wrote the story, Candace Crone.
Huh. Turn the moral enforcement into a logistical nightmare.
Exactly. Use humor and absurdity to push back against what he saw as prudish overreach.
Okay, but now we need to get into the comments where his aggressive style really backfired, where he had to issue public apologies. Let's start with that 2006 comment about the Green Party candidate, Carl Romanelli.
Right. Savage believed Romanelli was basically a spoiler candidate funded by Republicans to siphon votes.
And in an interview, his rhetoric just went way over the top.
Way over. He suggested Romanelli should be dragged behind a pickup truck until there's nothing left but the rope, or just run over.
I mean, that's extreme language, even for him.
Absolutely extreme. And the condemnation was swift and widespread. Savage had to immediately issue a regret and an apology. Calling the truck metaphor stupid, rude, thoughtless. He emphasized he didn't mean the threat literally at all, but it really highlighted the risks of using that kind of violent hyperbole in political talk.
And it wasn't an isolated incident. A few years later, 2011, he did something similar on Real Time with Bill Maher during that tense debt negotiation period.
That's right. He was expressing his utter frustration with the congressional Republicans blocking things, and he just blurted out, "I wish the Republicans were all fucking dead."
Another immediate walk back required.
Yep. Had to apologize quickly later that night on his blog. Said he didn't actually feel that way. Call it a flubbed expression of disgust. These moments really show that constant tension in his work.
Between wanting to use shocking language for effect.
And the literal harm or offense such language can actually cause, even if not intended literally.
But maybe the most audacious and personally consequential act of political provocateurism came much earlier. The 2000 Iowa caucuses incident.
Oh, yeah. That story's wild. Savage went to Iowa to cover the caucuses for Salon magazine.
And he was initially going to write about Gary Bauer, the conservative candidate.
Yeah, he apparently intended to write a sort of humanizing piece on Bauer. But then Bauer's anti-same-sex marriage comments just enraged Savage so much
that he abandoned the whole journalistic approach.
Completely. And what he claimed he did next was just shocking.
What did he claim?
He'd been sick with the flu. So he claimed he volunteered for the Bauer campaign specifically to try and spread the flu to Bauer and his staff.
Good out.
He claimed he licked doorknobs, coffee cups, other surfaces in the campaign office. And the most infamous detail, allegedly coated a pen in his saliva right before handing it directly to Gary Bauer himself.
He claimed he licked a pen and gave it to a presidential candidate. That's next-level provocation.
It truly is. And the description, when published in Salon, led to immediate and harsh criticism. Camille Paglia, who also wrote for Salon, called the described behavior sociopathic.
Did Savage stand by the story?
He later clarified. Said the story was highly exaggerated for comedic effect, more like journalistic performance art. Claimed the doorknob licking was made up and insisted he was actually no longer contagious by the time he joined the campaign team.
But the controversy didn't stop with just the sensational claims, did it? There were actual legal consequences from that Iowa trip.
That's right. It wasn't just performance. While he was there, Savage illegally registered and voted in the Republican caucus.
He actually voted illegally.
He did. And he later pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge. Fraudulent voting.
How was the penalty?
Got probation, had to do community service, and pay a fine. It's kind of a sobering reminder that pushing boundaries with performance art journalism can have very real, tangible costs.
Definitely. Okay, let's pivot a bit to his views on social issues, sexuality itself. He's described his approach to family as conservative, which seems counterintuitive given his public image.
Yeah, it sounds odd, but his point is that he values commitment, building a stable family unit, which is conservative in that traditional structural sense.
Okay.
However, he is deeply skeptical of what he calls simplistic views of monogamy. His column has consistently been a space to discuss, explore, and frankly normalize non-monogamy and polyamory for his readers, pushing boundaries there constantly.
And he caused a huge stir back in 1997 with a very blunt take on the AIDS crisis.
Oh, yeah. A reader wrote in and asked simply, "Is the AIDS crisis over?"
And Savage answered.
Just answered, yes. One word.
Wow. That must have generated some heat.
It generated weeks of intense discussion and debate right there in his column. His argument, contextually, was based on the medical reality emerging then.
The new treatments.
Right, the arrival of effective antiretroviral combination therapies. They were transforming HIV/AIDS, at least in developed countries with access, from a near-certain death sentence into a manageable chronic condition.
So he was saying the crisis of mass death was ending.
That was his point. Acknowledging the shift in the medical paradigm in places like the U.S., of course it was hugely controversial given the ongoing global pandemic, the high transmission rates, the lack of access elsewhere, but he was forcing his readers to confront that specific medical shift.
He seems willing to push against orthodoxy from any direction, left or right, which leads us, I think, to the most complex area of controversy surrounding him. His repeated clashes with parts of the LGBTQ plus community itself and allies, specifically around transgender issues.
Yeah, this is a significant and recurring point of friction in the sources. Savage has faced repeated sustained criticism for his use of slurs targeting the transgender community.
Slurs like?
Specifically the word tranny. And also for other remarks on trans issues, like jokingly suggesting former Washington Attorney General Rob McKenna was a transgender man, just generally seen as insensitive or harmful comments.
And these comments didn't just stay in the column, did they? They spilled out into real-world protests.
They did. Most famously, he was glitter-bombed 3 times.
Glitter-bombed.
Yeah, protesters threw glitter on him during public appearances, twice in 2011, once in 2012, explicitly alleging that his column and comments promoted transphobia.
And the controversy really came to a head during a seminar at the University of Chicago in 2014.
That was a major flashpoint. Savage was there talking about his own history with using the word tranny, discussing the idea of reclaiming slurs.
And a student objected.
A student asked him to please use the term T-slur instead of saying the actual word. Savage objected to that, the policing of language, he felt. And to make his point about discussing slurs openly, he apparently listed examples of various other slurs.
Which did not go over well.
No. Some students in the room claim they felt threatened, deeply uncomfortable, targeted by his use of those words, even as examples.
It illustrates that central paradox of his whole career, doesn't it?
Perfectly.
His goal, presumably, was to talk about repurposing hurtful words for empowerment, something he genuinely believes in and practiced with faggot.
Exactly. That was his defense. A university representative backed him up, saying he was clearly discussing the process of reclaiming language, not directing slurs at anyone in the room.
But the impact was different for some listeners.
Right. And Savage himself later demanded a public apology from the students or critics who had accused him of actual hatred. It just perfectly captures how volatile using abrasive language for progressive aims can be. The attempt to reclaim can simultaneously cause genuine offense and alienate the very allies you might need.
Okay, we also need to touch on his controversial comments from back in 2001 about child sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
This is obviously an extremely sensitive area.
Extremely. And the context is absolutely crucial here. Savage was arguing against what he saw as cultural hysteria surrounding children.
Saying society assumes what?
Saying society wrongly assumes children have absolutely no sexual agency or desire. That childhood is completely asexual, which he disputed.
Okay. But then he brought Ann Ambile into it.
Yes. And this is where it got really complicated and drew criticism. He critiqued Ambile, the North American Man-Boy Love Association, saying that group packages, potentially reasonable arguments about teen sexuality and age of consent laws, alongside irrational, insane arguments about seven-year-olds.
And that mixing, even just to critique Ambile, muddy the waters.
Hugely. Savage argued that because of Nambly's toxic association with pedophilia, any rational public discussion about acknowledging teen sexuality or debating age of consent laws becomes impossible. It just gets simply shouted down.
Yeah, so he was trying to distinguish between acknowledging healthy teen sexuality and protecting children from abuse.
But the mere proximity of his critique to Nambile, even to condemn their conflation, drew immediate and intense backlash. Very difficult territory.
Another major moment of public confrontation happened during an anti-bullying speech he gave in 2012.
Right. He was speaking to the National High School Journalism Convention, high school students.
And during the speech, he encouraged them to.
He encouraged the students to learn to ignore the bullshit in the Bible about gay people.
Okay. That's direct.
Very direct. And it prompted a walkout by some Christian students and advisors in the audience.
How did Savage react to the walkout?
His immediate reaction was apparently to call the walkout a pansy-assed move. He later apologized specifically for that comment, for the name-calling.
But not for the core message.
No. He stood firmly by the central point of his speech, which was anti-bullying and challenging religious justifications for bigotry against gay people.
His contrarian streak, like you said, even hit close to home, inside his own newspaper. We have to mention the criticism he got from his colleague Lindy West about fat shaming.
Yeah, that's an important one. In 2011, Lindy West, who worked with Savage at the Stranger Them, published this really powerful piece directly criticizing him.
For what specifically?
For repeated comments he'd made in his columns about fat people, saying things like, rolls of exposed flesh are unsightly, just casual digs.
And West's argument was?
That this was just a cruel, subjective opinion, and she called the act of shaming an already marginalized and shamed population shameful, especially coming from someone like Savage.
And this internal friction, this disagreement within the progressive media world there, it was later fictionalized, right?
Yeah, it became a significant storyline in the Hulu series Shrill, which was based on West's memoir. It really shows that even Savage's closest colleagues and allies sometimes felt compelled to publicly challenge his rhetorical choices and blind spots.
Okay, finally on the controversy front.
Yeah.
How did he respond in 2017 to the allegations against Kevin Spacey?
That was a moment where he applied his sharp moral line very clearly. When Kevin Spacey put out that statement, coming out as gay almost simultaneously with Anthony Rapp accusing him of assault when Rapp was only 14.
Savage's reaction was
quick and unequivocal. He tweeted something like, "There's no amount of drunk or closeted that excuses or explains away assaulting a 14-year-old child."
Drawing a very bright line.
Yeah. Using his platform instantly to say, basically, child abuse is child abuse. Full stop. Regardless of the alleged perpetrator's sexual orientation or status or whatever else was in that messy statement.
Okay, wow. So we have covered a lot of ground here. Video stores, Catholic seminary, search engine warfare, Emmy Awards, glitter bombs. It's time to try and pull this all together.
Yeah, synthesize it.
What's the essential summary? Savage's impact, his legacy as seen through these sources.
I think Savage's career is uniquely defined by these three simultaneous and often really contradictory pillars.
Okay, pillar one.
First, he's the essential guide, the voice of reason, science, empathy, and Savage love, the person people turn to for actual advice.
Pillar two.
Second, he's the massively successful activist, the co-founder of the Emmy-winning, genuinely life-saving It Gets Better project. That's undeniable impact.
And pillar three, the messy one.
Third, and maybe the most defining, yeah, he's the relentless cultural provocateur. The guy who invented Santorum, who claimed he licked pens for political protests, who constantly uses abrasive, shocking language to force difficult conversations into the public square. Like it or not.
His career really feels like the ultimate test case for blending radical sex positivity with super aggressive political commentary and highly visible public advocacy.
He didn't wait for change. He instigated it using every single medium available to him.
And his influence, it's recognized well beyond just the alt-weekly world or the LGBTQ community.
Oh, yeah. The awards for his books alone show that. The kid won a Penn and West Award back in 99. Skipping Towards Gamora won a Lambda Literary Award in 2002.
And he got that Humanist of the Year Award.
Right, from the American Humanist Association in 2013. Specifically for his advocacy of church-state separation and, crucially, his work for LGBTQ youth. He has a legitimate claim, I think, to being one of the most culturally influential columnists of the last, what, 30 years?
He really does.
Yeah.
The sources also consistently show that his specific method, that enthusiastic, hypercharged, abrasive language, even when used, arguably, in the name of reclaiming slurs or advancing progressive causes, it frequently led to public apologies or intensified scrutiny, not just from opponents, but often from allies.
That paradox is what defines him. Savage proved that shock tactics absolutely generate visibility. They can win campaigns like the Santorum effort, undeniably.
The cost.
The cost, as we saw with the transgender controversies, the fat-shaming critiques, is often paid in trust, in alliance, within the very coalition he was at least ostensibly trying to build or support.
Which brings us perfectly to our final provocative thought for you, the listener, to maybe chew on.
Yeah.
When you're navigating these really complex cultural and political issues, especially ones that require huge shifts in public opinion, is the success of a movement better served by, well, Savage's signature style? That enthusiastic, abrasive provocation that grabs attention dominates headlines.
Or is it better served by more measured, maybe more careful language? language that deliberately seeks to avoid alienating potential allies, that prioritizes building broader, even if maybe slower, coalitions.
Savage's entire legacy forces us to confront that fundamental choice, rhetorical velocity versus rhetorical patience.
It's a powerful dilemma, a really potent question to leave you with.
We've covered everything from seminary to sovereignty, from scandal to success, and that's our deep dive into the complicated career of Dan Savage. Thank you for joining us.
Dive deeper next time.